It is very nice to be here. I live in Toronto, even if I work out at the Perimeter Institute. And moving to Toronto has certainly been the best thing that ever happened to me. So I'm very happy to be here. So Eric mentioned this book. So I wrote a book, and this talk is largely based on it. We had a disagreement between myself and the people who invited me because they wanted to hear the talk on the book. When you write a book, you go around and you give talks on the book, which are popular talks. And I wanted to talk about what's new in the research that the people I work with are doing in quantum gravity. So I was convinced that this is a talk related to the book. It is basically the book talk with a level raised. That is, many of the transparencies come from the book talk, but I've added material because this is a physics colloquium and people here, I can assume, know basic physics and are familiar with the context. I want to say the purpose partly of the book was to evaluate different approaches to quantum gravity, including but not only string theory, and worry about certain issues which have come up in the course of research the last 20 years in string theory. There were other purposes of the book. The original purpose of the book, and I'm very glad that some people from philosophy, Jim Brown and other people, are here, because this was originally to be a book in which I stepped out into their field and wrote a book about philosophy of science. It didn't quite turn out that way, but the backbone and, for me, the central interest in the book is the question about how science works. And therefore, I'm going to start with that issue in the talk. And then we're going to be doing two things at the same time as I talk about the problem of quantum gravity. One of them is talking about and comparing results from the status of different approaches to the problem of quantum gravity. And we're also going to be using a debate within the field of quantum gravity as a test case for thinking about how debate and controversy work in the history and philosophy of science. Because, as you'll see, a key element of how science works is that when there is not consensus in the field, disagreement is healthy. Of course, assuming that that disagreement is respectful and scientific and not aimed at people's how badly they dress and stuff like that. I believe that the discussions in the book were at that level. So I'm going to start talking about quantum gravity and the problem of quantum gravity. The problem of quantum gravity is how to complete the revolution started in 20th century physics by Einstein and others, in which we broke away from Newtonian physics through the quantum mechanics, starting in 1905 and formalized in 1926. And general relativity, Einstein's theory of space and time and gravity, which each broke from Newtonian physics in revolutionary ways. In quantum mechanics, in terms of things like the uncertainty principle, the wave-particle duality, a complicated and difficult to understand for some of us, including the relationship between what's observed and what is described in the physics. And general relativity, which broke away from Newtonian mechanics in a different way, as you'll see, because this is a major theme of this talk, by making the geometry of space and time not part of the laws of physics, but something that evolves dynamically subject to the laws of physics. Now, what is science? Now, we have some philosophers here, so they will tell you, at least this is the lesson I've learned, maybe I've learned badly, you can tell me, that what I learned in high school as to how science works is wrong. What we learned in high school is that there's a method, you get a notebook, you write down your observations, you make hypotheses, you check them, etc. And that following such methods do not account for the success of science. And by the way, I do not question, this is not one of these things where one questions the success of science. I take the success of science as given and to be explained. So various people, Popper, Feyerabend, and Kuhn, and there are whole courses which presumably are given here in the university about their views about how science works, argue that there is no scientific method. Science is a human activity and much more complicated than something that can be contained in the carrying out of a method. So how does it work? And I have a proposal, and it was really to explore that proposal that I wrote this book. And the proposal is that scientists form a community that's bound and governed by ethical principles. That is, there are no hard and fast rules to what you must do, how you must decide what's true and what's not, but there are ethical principles. And this is not an original view, but it's one that I came to trying to sort this out. So here is one way to put the ethical principles. Science is about what can be deduced from public evidence. And there are two cases. There are cases where people of good faith, and I'll come back to that phrase, okay, by applying rational arguments to publicly available evidence, can decide whether one hypothesis is supported over a competing hypothesis, or can decide whether a prediction of a theory has been verified or falsified. And in those cases, the ethical principle is we have to agree that it's so decided, even if we don't like it, even if it destroys our fondest hopes. So, for example, even if I have romantic ideas about modified Newtonian dynamics as opposed to dark matter, I have to admit that the Bullitt cluster gives a very strong case in favor of dark matter. Okay. On the other hand, there are cases where we do not have enough evidence, or we don't have the basis of making a rational argument from the evidence to consensus, and then we must agree to disagree, and we must even allow and encourage people to draw diverse conclusions. And good faith here, which is, I learned to put that in from a sculptor friend, St. Clair Simin, who used in the context of aesthetics. It basically means that you have bought these principles and you see yourself as part of a community where the judgment of the community in the long term is more important than your individual judgment. Okay. So, and that is just an ethical stance that you have to take. You can always disagree, but if you disagree from outside of this stance of recognizing that you're a part of this community that's governed by some principles, then you're outside of science. Okay, that's the thesis. Okay, why? Okay, the point is that scientific research, this is almost a tautology, but scientific research is about what we don't know. It's confronting the unknown. And when we confront stubbornly hard problems, we should encourage people, when we don't know the answer, to take risks with big, courageous, risky ideas. We should encourage different approaches because we don't know the answer. These are all things that follow from these principles. And indeed, and this is something that Paul Feyerabend argued, and I disagree with a lot of stuff in Paul Feyerabend, but I also agree with a lot of stuff, and this is one I do agree with. Science moves fastest when we cultivate diverse and conflicting approaches to unsolved problems. Conflict motivates imagination. People work harder when there is disagreement and conflict. And when there's not enough disagreement, when there's too much agreement, we miss things as a community, and progress can slow down. Okay. Now, the basis of physics, there are different sciences, but the basics of physics is experiment. And part of buying into the ethics in the context of physics is buying into this, and there are many places to get this from, but Brian Greene emphasized when we talked a few days ago that this was his view, so I wanted to emphasize that there is no way of establishing that any theory applies to the world or describes the world without subjecting its predictions to experimental verification. Okay. That is how, in physics, we gather that evidence to decide whether theories or hypotheses are true. Okay. Now, therefore, what is the experimental context for quantum gravity? Before I talk about theories, I want to talk about what's the experimental context. Because without an experimental context, we may be doing something very interesting. It may be interesting mathematically, interesting philosophically, but it doesn't have a chance to be science. Okay. So the scales, and most people here will know that, that are relevant for quantum gravity come from putting together the constants of nature that are relevant, Planck's constant, Newton's gravitational constant, and the speed of light. And the length that you get, and I forgot to take a square root there, is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, so that's a very small length scale, or inversely, an energy scale of 10 to the 19 GeV. So roughly 20 orders of magnitude smaller than or more energetic than a proton. Okay. Where could phenomenon be observed at these scales? Okay. And if the answer was we don't have any, again, it would be of interest. And people did quantum gravity when they didn't know the answer to this question, but wouldn't have a chance to become, to cross that line from things that people are interested to study and debate about to something that might become consensus and become part of science. Okay. So first of all, it turns out, as I'll be telling you, there is a question that you can get at order of the Planck length. That is, you can test systems which have energy E, and to order L Planck times E, which is with h bar a dimensionless number, you can ask, is Poincaré invariance, which is an assumption of special relativity, true or broken or modified? And I'll be talking about that. Second, we have an experimental laboratory in the early universe, and assuming either that inflation is a correct description or some one of the alternatives to inflation that people have discussed, you have to deal with an energy scale E, I say inflation, which is typically only sort of 4 or 5 orders of magnitude off the Planck energy. So this is a number now. The number involving L Planck is now a number of 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 3. And could there be corrections that a quantum theory of gravity could predict coming from a description of the early universe to observations we made about the cosmic microwave wave background to that order that could be observed? And again, I'll come back to that. And third, there's been for a long time a hypothesis that getting quantum gravity right would tell us something about the problem of unification. That is, the problem of whether there is a theory that goes beyond the standard model from 1973 and really fits together all the four different forces and the different kinds of fermions in one simple structure, perhaps as all different states of one thing. Okay? And that's a hypothesis which has been investigated and is still being investigated from different points of view of quantum gravity. Okay, so that's the experimental context. Now, we used to think, okay, and this is just a sort of preview of what's coming, we used to think that it was impossible to do experiments to probe the scale of the Planck length. Okay, we used to say things like an accelerator powerful enough to study that energy of 10 to the 19 GeV would have to be as large as the galaxy. Therefore, there are no experiments. Okay. And part of the story that I'll get to at the end of the talk is that we were very foolish. And this is one reason why it's good to have not everybody agreeing too much, because the people who realized that this is wrong and we have access to experiment were people like Giovanni Emilino Camelia in Rome and other people who were kind of on the fringes of things, but were thinking about there must be some way to test quantum gravity. And they realized that we have access to experiments which are much bigger than the universe, than the galaxy, which is the universe as a whole, that as we see particles which travel across appreciable fractions of the universe, like photons from gamma ray bursts, and that gives us an experimental window. I'll come back to that. But that's, the whole talk hinges on that fact. Okay, now, the second book that I wrote is Three Roads to Quantum Gravity, in which I said that there are three roads. And one of the things that is remarkable about the field of quantum gravity and makes it hard for people not working in it to understand, and indeed is something that we are puzzled about, and I was very puzzled about, was the fact that there are different roads being followed by different communities of people who are not in good communication with each other. And why is that? And after a lot of thinking about it, I think I finally understand that. And that's that two of the roads come from competing ideas and very old ideas, in a competition between ideas that's been going on for a long time about how to think of the notion of properties with respect to space and time. That is, the basic question, when you have an elementary particle or an elementary object and it lives in space and time, it has properties, how do we define what an elementary particle is and what its properties are? And there are two views of that which go back at least to the 17th century. Of course, you can, if I was a real scholar, I would be tracing this back sometime to the Greeks or the Egyptians or the Babylonians or something. But I can trace it back to the 17th century. So one of the view was Newton's view. And Newton's view is that space has a geometry which is fixed. It's absolute. It's meaningful to say where something is in space. And particles get their properties with respect to where they are with respect to absolute space. And this is called the absolute viewpoint. And Newton had a theological, there are two interesting things about this. Newton had a theological motivation for this. And second, that this was not the majority point of view among people who were thinking about the problem then, but it was the most successful point of view. The majority point of view among the small groups of people who worried about these things were the point of view which is usually identified with Leibniz, that there is no such thing as space without matter or time without change, that fundamentally there are things in the world and they have relationships with change, and the world is best described as some network of relationships which changes, and space is an aspect of those relationships and time is an aspect of change in those relationships. And I probably murdered that a little bit, but that's roughly speaking is the view that we identify with Leibniz. Okay. And this is called a relational view and this is called an absolute view. 3 centuries later, roughly, we use different names in our discussions about quantum gravity. The first kind of approach is called background dependent. That is, one can trace a set of approaches, as I'll be describing, their use and their treatment of space and time back to this philosophical framework. And the other is called background independent. Because in the first, the geometry of space sits as a background and defines properties. In the second, there is no background which is fixed, which defines properties. Let me just say two things about this, which in the public version of the talk I go into quite a bit. Okay. One of them is that this choice of different ways of understanding properties of subsystems of something you can find in lots of different domains, from theology to mathematics. Okay. Second, there's even a novel about this. I don't know if anybody here reads Neal Stephenson, but Neal Stephenson's Baroque Trilogy is a 3,000-page novel about the attempts of a certain Princess Caroline, who was a historical figure, who indeed did attempt to get a reconciliation between Newton and Leibniz because of her fears about what would happen to the future of Christianity were they not reconciled, because there were theological implications. And this person wrote a novel about that because they're still not reconciled. Okay. Now, in the 20th century revolution, both points of view had great successes. Ordinary quantum mechanics and quantum field theory treat space and time in this background-dependent or Newtonian way. You just give the geometry of space. It doesn't matter if the geometry of space is Minkowski space-time rather than some Euclidean space. You give the geometry of space, then you give degrees of freedom that live in it, that get their properties from their motion through the geometry of space, which never changes. And all the successes of the standard model of particle physics, quantum electrodynamics, etc., are in this framework, in this language. This is ordinary quantum mechanics. The background independent point of view was finally realized in a way that could really be experimentally tested. See, Leibniz had very good arguments, but he had no actual mathematical theory that could be compared against Newton's theory in terms of making predictions. Finally, it was Einstein in the invention of general relativity who figured out a way to put this philosophy that space and time are nothing but aspects of relationships between things into a mathematical framework, which was a physical theory, and make predictions and test it. And general relativity has survived all those tests. And it's interesting that although In some intuitive sense, Einstein understood this, that is, he was guided by his readings of Mach, who was certainly very strongly influenced by Leibniz and other philosophers. It was not really till the 1970s that the mathematical structure of general relativity was understood in a way which let one state cleanly that the observable quantities in general relativity are about relationships between dynamical objects. And it was really Julian Barber who figured that out. John Stachel also played a role in the 1970s. So this is something that we had to learn rather painfully, and I think the reason it took so long to learn it as communities, and I can say also as an individual, because I was trained as a particle physicist, is that the way of thinking about the world in general relativity is so radically different to the way that you grow up with in Newtonian mechanics and quantum field theory and so forth. And it's also true that some of us who strongly argue that that interpretation of general relativity is irreversible are in some sense mentorees of Julian Barber. That is, we have all made our pilgrimage, so to speak, out to his house in the English countryside and spent weeks sitting talking with him about what general relativity really meant and how to think about it. Okay. So, no wonder quantum gravity and unification are hard problems, because we're trying to bring together the successes of two things, general relativity on one side and quantum field theory in the standard model on the other side, and they live in different, very different ways of thinking about basic questions like what's a property, what's space, what's time, how do properties of things relate to space and time. And it's not surprising either that these are two of the three roads to quantum gravity. There are two different approaches to the problem which come from being situated mentally in one way of thinking about space and time or the other. In fact, this has been true since the 1930s. There's another aspect of this, and in my book, at the end of writing a book, which I recommend to everybody, just don't do it more than once, but some people here have done it many more times than I have, but it's worth doing once because it really forces you to think through the problem that you're writing about. And I ended up writing about the sociology of science, and that was only at the very end because my editor kept telling me the story you're telling doesn't make any sense without it. And this is what I really finally think I understood. It's an aspect. I mean, there's lots of stuff which is common to the sociology of everything that is discussed, but what was really relevant for physics is that these different viewpoints are furthered or studied in different communities, and these different communities have different styles because they go back historically, and you can trace this through patterns of who was a teacher or mentor of who, to the two different styles which have been successful in the 20th century. Early in the 20th century, there was a style of research which was very oriented towards solving foundational problems. It was very philosophically motivated. The people who led it were very conversant with and at home in the philosophical tradition and the histories of their subject, people like Einstein, Bohr, and Schrodinger, and wrote about history and philosophy. The style of research was to meditate, to think hard and deeply about fundamental issues about what space, time, matter, and motion are. Okay, have dialogues among people who disagree. And this style is very good for making scientific revolutions. And it produced general relativity and quantum mechanics. And there continue to be people who work in this style. For example, Roger Penrose and Alain Cohn are two of the better known of them. And people in this style, it turns out, tend to embrace the viewpoint of background independence, in some cases because there's a legacy that traces back to Einstein or Schrodinger or Bohr. Okay. But it turns out that style actually died for effectively, as far as effectiveness is concerned, really faded out a long time ago. And the reason is that by the 1930s, when quantum mechanics was made, okay, some of these people were still spending all their time arguing with each other about the meaning of quantum mechanics and the philosophy of quantum mechanics. And a younger generation came along and said, you guys are wasting your time. We have quantum mechanics. We can use it to understand radiation, matter, solid-state physics, astrophysics, stars, etc. Let's be more pragmatic. Take for granted that we have a good theory and build on it. And this philosophy, this style, a more pragmatic style, is epitomized by Fermi. Many people talk about Fermi as a break from it. Of course, then Feynman is sort of epitomizes the sort of an American version of it. Gell-Mann, Weinberg, Glashow. These are the people who trained me. And there was a disdain for philosophy. There was a disdain for history. The idea was to, you know, stop asking these hard questions about quantum mechanics and calculate something about the standard model, because we have. And by that time, there was the standard model. We have the standard model. Let's do physics. Okay. And not surprisingly, the triumph of this style was many things. I mean, all of condensed matter physics, atomic physics, nuclear physics, astrophysics, etc. But as far as elementary particle physics is concerned, was the standard model. And not surprisingly, people coming from that pragmatic attitude and style tend to think about space and time in background-dependent ways, because that's how we were trained. And I'm one of them who happened to be lucky enough to meet Julian Barber sort of shortly after I got my PhD. But, I mean, we were trained to think about physics in a background space. And that was the basis of the standard model. So that's I'm being clear what I'm doing. I'm making a hypothesis about the history and the structure of the subject, because I'm trying to understand why there are different approaches to quantum gravity. Okay. Now, let's trace these two different roads. Okay. There's the background-dependent approach. And this goes back to the first reference I can find. By the way, Einstein, in a paper in 1916 on gravitational radiation, which was the first paper on gravitational waves, already mentions that there has to be a quantum theory of gravity, because radiation has to be quantized, otherwise there would be inconsistency with the Bohr atom. Okay? But the first real paper about quantum gravity that I know of that mentions quantum gravity appeared within the quantum field theory approach. It was in the same paper of Heisenberg and Pauli where they first successfully quantized the electromagnetic field. Okay? And they say towards the end of the paper, quantization of the gravitational field, which appears to be necessary for physical reasons, may be carried out without any new difficulties by means of a formalism fully analogous to that applied here. Okay. And that is indeed the largest underestimation of the difficulty of a scientific problem I know of in print. The first work I know about espousing a background-independent approach, and I didn't know about this person or his work until I was almost finishing the book, is somebody called Matvey Bronstein, who in the first PhD thesis ever written about quantum gravity in what was then called Leningrad in 1935. Okay, and I haven't read the whole thing. I've just read translations of pieces of it which have appeared. There's a scholar at BU who is in the course of translating his work, wrote that the elimination of the logical inconsistencies between quantum mechanics and general relativity requires rejection of our ordinary concepts of space and time, modifying them by some much deeper and non-evident concepts. So already at the very beginning, there was a disagreement about how to proceed. Okay. Unfortunately, those were turbulent times, and Bronstein is not, at the time, he was thought to be one of the two bright hopes of Soviet science, the other being Lev Landau. Unfortunately, he also was politically active, and he was arrested and killed in 1937. So he did not get a chance to work that out. Okay. Now, here's the history of the different approaches. Okay. The history of the first road is full of attempts that didn't work. Then there's a great success, which is Hawking applied ordinary quantum field theory to a certain background, which was not Minkowski space-time, but the space-time of a black hole. And he found that a black hole should radiate. That made sense of and confirmed work a little earlier, a year or two earlier, by Jacob Bekenstein, in which he argued that black holes would have entropy. And that's a great success, and still the sort of shining success of the field. Then there were lots of things that didn't work. My PhD thesis is in there. What I did in my first postdoc is in there. What I did in my second postdoc is in there, and so forth. Which we can talk about. You know, there's lots of stuff which is better forgotten. Large N expansions, large dimension expansions, Lee-Wick mechanisms, lattice models, etc. And then there was the invention, not the invention of string theory, I'm sorry, but the convincing argument that there were string theories which were consistent quantum mechanically by Green and Schwarz in 1984. And then many things have happened since. The history of the second road was much the same. Some people, there were actually interesting stuff in these failures. For example, Paul Dirac spent years and years on this problem of trying to formulate a background independent formulation of quantum gravity, as did many other great physicists and mathematicians, but nothing really worked until Abhay Ashtekar in 1986 found that general relativity was a kind of gauge theory. That is, that the dynamical degrees of freedom were a gauge field or a Yang-Mills field, just like in the standard model. And that was the beginning of loop quantum gravity, spin foam models, dynamical triangulations, and a bunch of stuff that I'll be talking about. Okay. So for about 20 years on each side, there's been real interesting stuff, real very non-trivial stuff on both sides. Lots and lots of non-trivial stuff, much too much to summarize in a talk, let alone half a talk. Okay, but I think I've set up the basics. But I will do as much as I can in the remaining time that I have. Interestingly, string theory and loop quantum gravity, if one wants to contrast them, both express in these different contexts the same fundamental insight. And this is an insight that the fundamental things are not points, they're one-dimensional extended lines in space. I mean, this has been deepened in various ways on both sides, but this is the fundamental insight. And interestingly, this insight goes back to Faraday. Or one can, anyway, in a certain sense, claim it goes back to Faraday. Because Faraday's first concept of electricity and magnetism, where there were charges and there were lines of force between them, and there were magnetic poles and lines of force between them, and Faraday really believed that those lines of force were lines in space, and he tried to write down equations that described them, and that was how Faraday conceived of electromagnetism. Now, Maxwell came along some years after that and said, no, the fundamental thing are really fields. The lines of force are just fictitious curves that one gets by integrating some of the vector fields, the electric field and the magnetic field. Okay? But Maxwell said the fundamental thing are local fields that satisfy differential equations. Now, it turns out that in some cases when you take those field theories, Maxwell's theory or Yang-Mills theory, okay, and you treat them quantum mechanically, in certain circumstances, Faraday's insight comes back. The most understood, physically and experimentally, is in superconductors, the lines of magnetic flux. The magnetic flux is quantized, and there really are physical degrees of freedom which are lines of magnetic flux. And there's an old idea, the dual superconductor hypothesis, it's sometimes called, that you can understand QCD by saying that in the vacuum, the lines of electric flux of the QCD gauge field are quantized and there are discrete lines of force, just as there are for the magnetic field in a superconductor. And the idea arose in the 1960s, people like Holger Nielsen, Stanley Mandelstam, that the right way to understand gauge theories quantum mechanically was to try to write dynamical equations for those quantized lines of force directly. So that the dynamics would be described not by field equations, but by equations that took the quantized lines of force as fundamental things and gave them equations of motion quantum mechanically. Okay. And that carried out in a background-dependent context that is carried out by people who are thinking these lines of force live in a space which has Euclidean geometry or Minkowskian geometry, in a certain sense became string theory. Carried out by people who thought that the lines of force actually, using Ashtekar's discovery, represent the geometry of space and therefore they don't live in any prior geometry, but they are the dynamics of geometry, the idea became loop quantum gravity. The ideas are linked. And I think it's important to mention that because it's possible, by no means certain, but possible, and this was actually the purpose of my second book, was to argue this because I believed this strongly at the time, about 5 or 6 years ago, that really they're different sides of the same thing because they have the same underlying physical idea. Okay. Now, let's follow one and then the other. And by the way, I'm not going to say anything that experts in the field don't know and largely agree about. Okay. String theory certainly has compelling features. It turns out that under certain conditions, which I'll be discussing in a minute, all the known kinds of particles, as kinds of fermions and gauge fields, plus gravitons, can be understood as vibrations of strings stretched in space, closed or open strings. The motion and the interaction of those strings do obey simple laws, which is impressive, moving in space. The theory is described at first, there's more known about it now, but the theory at first, the actual theory of the strings is described via approximation methods, which are very familiar to us because they are a kind of what's called perturbation theory. They're expansions in a small dimensionless parameter, and they have this somewhat different but of very similar features to that we use in quantum field theory. Those calculations give finite and consistent answers to at least, I say here, the third order of approximation. That means genus 2, if people, because in string theory, the higher order, the order of approximation is the number of holes in the surface of the string that's propagating. Okay? The mathematics is very beautiful. No doubt, and there have been very important spin-offs to mathematics, and there are beautiful connections to the mathematics of the Standard Model and applications through them to the physics of the Standard Model, for example, QCD. Okay. So all of that is compelling and is a great success. The story of string theory is so puzzling. Okay, I want to emphasize that. This is not, I mean, various things have been said about my book. It's against string theory, it's an attack, etc. There's no such thing. String theory is a puzzle because it has compelling features and it has puzzling, worrying features. And I think that we are, you know, there's nothing like it that I know of in the history of physics. Okay. Then there is the puzzling, difficult features come from what, to be cute, I call the package deal. The package deal should remind you of when you go to buy a car and you want to buy a car with anti-lock brakes and a CD player and they insist on throwing on magnesium chrome wheels and leather seat backs and racing stripes and cup holders and a sunroof and so forth because that's part of the package deal and you can't get out of it. And I still don't know what magnesium chrome wheels are, but I have them on my Toyota, okay? So it turns out that the compelling features of string theory, at least so far as we know, come with a package deal. And the package deal is there are 6 extra dimensions of space. Okay. Sometimes we think about a 7th, and I'll come to that. Okay. But as far as the propagation of strings is concerned, 6. And there's an extra constraint on the dynamics, which is called supersymmetry. And many of you here will know about it. And supersymmetry, of course, is an idea that exists apart from string theory and will be tested at the LHC in a few years. Okay. But so far, there's no observational evidence for either of these. Okay. And this is where the story of string theory goes in a different direction than might have been expected. If these were not the case, if we had a consistent non-supersymmetric string theory in the 3+1 dimensions we observe, then life would have been much, much simpler. We would be just studying that theory. There would be one theory. We would be studying it and trying to connect it to experiment. Okay. these extra features in the package deal have changed completely the direction of most people's research in the area, either for good or for bad, because these things are either true or they're not true in nature. And by buying into the compelling features of string theory, so far as we know, you buy into that. Okay. And that's disturbing. That is, there's something very compelling there, but then it tells you you have to buy other things which are not so far observed. A lot of hope rests on the extra dimensions, but a lot of trouble. And these are from the public talk, but so there are more technical ways to say all of this. I hope you don't mind my using non-technical language. The extra dimensions have to be curled up very small to hide them, or you can do something equivalent by imposing symmetries and making them very large and have certain ADS geometries. There are an infinite number of ways to do that, as far as we know, to the order that we can understand these, consistent with the equations of propagation of a quantum string. These lead to an infinite number of different string theories based on different choices for the geometry and topology of the six extra dimensions. And by the way, there are also string theories in which you curl up very small all nine of the spatial dimensions, or only two of them, or none of them. So these are only the ones that might be relevant to our world. Okay. The properties of the elementary particles and forces depends on the choices made for the geometries of the extra dimensions. In a way, that's very beautiful. There's something explanatory there, potentially. That is, why are the Higgs couplings the way they are in the Sterren model? Because of the geometry of a certain manifold in six dimensions. But because there's an infinite number of choices for those manifolds, as well as for the parameters that describe the geometries of those manifolds, we get no predictions. That's basically, in one transparency, the conundrum that we're in. Doesn't quite end there. There's also an issue which actually Einstein understood. And it was interesting for me to study this and write about this in the book, because I didn't know any of this history. The idea of extra dimensions goes back. Does anybody know? Well, some people here have read the book. Okay, I won't make it a quiz. The first paper which uses an extra dimension to unify gravity and electromagnetism is pre-general relativity. It's 1914 Nordstrom. Okay. It was for a while a competing idea with general relativity, which general relativity won because there was experimental evidence for it. The bending of light was true in Einstein's theory and not in Nordstrom's theory. So the talk you sometimes hear that general relativity is a triumph of pure thought over anything else is just wrong. General relativity is a triumph of old-fashioned science because there were definitive experiments within a few years after the invention of the theory that led to its triumph over competing theories. Okay, and Nordstrom's five-dimensional unification was one of them. Shortly after that, the idea asserted it for itself again in 1919 by Kaluza. Einstein at first fell in love with the idea. And then by 1923, he was writing to friends that it had to fail. And it's interesting why it had to fail. This is a quote from several letters where he discussed it. It is anomalous to replace the four-dimensional continuum by a five-dimensional one, and then subsequently to tie up artificially one of those five dimensions in order to account for the fact that it doesn't manifest itself. What Einstein meant was that if it's really a unification, then the extra dimensions, like the three dimensions we know about, have dynamical geometries. And that means that the properties of elementary particles should change in time, because there can be gravitational waves in the extra dimensions, and they would lead to oscillations in the masses and coupling constants of particles. And that's not seen. And that was an issue in 1923, and it's an issue in 2006. Okay. Also, the new dimensions can collapse to singularities, or they can get big, so we would observe them. Okay. Now, there are, in modern language, this is known as the problem of stabilizing the moduli. The moduli are parameters that describe the geometry of the extra dimensions, and there was an open problem in string theory until about 2003 to find evidence for a version of string theory where they were completely stabilized. That is, where these things couldn't happen. Okay. Now we have, at the zeroth order of approximation, evidence for such theories where the moduli stabilize. and these issues don't happen, but unfortunately we have evidence for an infinite number of those. Okay, and that's the first, that's really why there's a worry. Now, supersymmetry is either a triumph or a problem. Okay. It requires, and again, this is most of you know this, it requires that there are super partners, which are so far not observed. It requires that the cosmological constant is not positive, but it was observed in 1998 to be positive. It implies that the geometry of space does not involve in time, that is, that the gravitons can propagate consistently on, and I'll use technical language first, supersymmetry requires that the manifold that the gravitons propagate on, if the gravitons come from consistent modes of strings, must have a global time-like or null Killing field. It means that there's a direction of time where they don't change. Okay, but we know that there are gravitational waves and geometry evolves in time and the universe is expanding and so forth. Hence, supersymmetry, if it's true, must be broken or hidden. It could be true. The issue then becomes, where is it broken? How is it hidden? Okay. And that becomes an experimental question. Unfortunately, because there are so many versions, and the versions have so many parameters, there's no prediction for where supersymmetry, if true, how it's broken, and where it's hidden. Another issue is that many properties are known about supersymmetric string theories, but we know that the string theory, if there's a string theory that describes nature, it's not supersymmetric, and we know very little about such theories, unfortunately, which makes it very difficult to evaluate the case for them, because we're talking about a theory that has not been written down. That is, if there's a string theory that describes nature, it's a theory that has not been written down, because those that have been written down and studied have a property that's of exact supersymmetry that's not observed, whereas what we observe is no supersymmetry, which means either no supersymmetry or broken supersymmetry. And we know very little about such theories. Okay, just some other things. And I think I'm running slower than I expected to, so I'll. But let me just state there are other conjectures which there's impressive evidence for some of them. For example, perturbative finiteness. It's demonstrated through second order in the string coupling constant by heroic work of Doker and Fong, but it's still an open conjecture. Something called strong weak duality or S duality. Again, there's evidence for it, but no proof. M theory, the idea that all the different string theories are different solutions of a single 11-dimensional unification four. It's a beautiful proposal made about a little more than 10 years ago. There's evidence for it. Some properties and some limits of the conjecture theories are known, but there's no proposal for what that theory is. That is, nobody has written down these are the principles of M theory or these are the equations of M theory apart from certain limits. Okay, and then there's the Maldacena conjecture, which again, and I think I'm going to skip a little bit because I want to come to the landscape, but the Maldacena conjecture is a conjecture of a relationship between string theory and supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. There's a lot of evidence, compelling evidence for some version of the conjecture, but no clear formulation of the strongest case of the conjecture. Okay. Then there's the strange story of the landscape. And the strange story of the landscape is really comes to the present crisis. And I think it is a crisis. In 1984, we were so excited about string theory because we thought it was unique. In 1985, we realized that to get theories with n equals 1 supersymmetry at elementary particle scales, there were hundreds of thousands of ways to do that through Calabi-Yau manifolds, maybe even more. In 1986, Strominger realized actually there were an infinite number of ways to do that, anticipating what's now called flux compactifications in terms of torsion. Okay. And right away, there was worry by Strominger and a number of other people that predictive power seems to have been lost because there will be a vast number of theories. So this is not a new problem. Okay. It was on the table since 1986. And some people, like Andrew Strominger and some people at CERN, Lurch, for example, have been worrying about it since. My first book was about that and was really aimed at taking seriously the idea that there is a vast number of theories in how you still could have predictive power. I invented this idea, which was the landscape of theories, which was by analogy with fitness landscapes in biology, and thought about the problem and studied it and presented one kind of solution. And other people, a few other people, were doing the same thing. Okay. So this problem has been with us from the beginning. Okay. There was the conjecture of M-theory in 1995, which gave us a lot of hope. In 1998, the cosmological constant was observed to be positive, which ruled out all known then versions of string theory. And then in 2003, there was the great breakthrough of Katru and collaborators, building on work of Busso, Polchinski, and others, that one could have string theories with positive cosmological constant or dark energy with completely stable moduli. Okay. And that's where we are now. Okay. So that's, I've sort of said all of this. That's the present situation. And it is a puzzle. What was compelling is still compelling. Key conjectures remain open, however. Unfortunately, there's no predictions whatsoever. And there's no program which has, you know, a clear time limit to make predictions. We don't know really what the theory is. We have, if there is one theory here, we have evidence for it, but we don't know what it is, although a lot of smart people have been thinking about it. There are some applications to heavy ion physics, for example, which don't test whether it's a fundamental theory, but are interesting, useful applications. So there's a puzzle. And there have been different approaches to this puzzle. In 2003, when it became clear that the landscape problem had to be faced, Lenny Susskind proposed that the way to deal with it was to revive the anthropic principle. The anthropic principle, in the weak form, which is the one that he referred to, says that there are an infinite number of universes, each is governed randomly by some version of string theory, and we live in one where life is possible, and we can only make predictions that are consequences of our own existence. This was an old idea at the time. It goes back to the 1970s from some eminent astronomers and cosmologists, and detailed arguments already existed to show that there are very few such predictions that could be made. Now, it might be that if there are correlations, that is, if there are properties which all those theories share, that you can make predictions. And that's what I had argued in my first book, that there might be a way of making an ensemble of string theories, that there would be properties that all the theories share. But so far, there's really no evidence for that. Okay. So by 2004, 2005, my understanding is that there was beginning to be an understanding that this brave hope was not going to work. And then there began to be really some disturbing proposals from very eminent people. Lenny Susskind, who has always been a role model for me, Steve Weinberg, likewise one of the great living scientists, began to say things like, and I'll just paraphrase, sometimes there are revolutions in science, and sometimes there are revolutions in our concept of what science is and how science worked. And they challenged explicitly the idea that a scientific theory must make falsifiable predictions in order to be considered possibly true. Okay. Lenny Susskind, for example, who always puts things in few succinct words, said it would be very foolish to throw away the right answer on the basis that it doesn't conform to some criteria for what is or isn't science. That's from an interview with Nature. So some very provocative statements were being made. Okay. And if there's a controversy now, and if there's a controversy with Peter Woit's book and my book, and by the way, Roger Penrose's book and Lawrence Krauss's book of last year, which also all make the same point, the controversy is intended as an answer to these provocative statements, because that was really the origin of the controversy. Are the features of string theory so compelling that one should consider it as true, or a good candidate, or the best candidate for being true, in spite of not satisfying the criteria that most people and most scientists and historians and philosophers of science have some version or another of thought had to be imposed. Okay. Now, I should mention that not everybody in string theory agrees with Susskind and Weinberg. Brian Green doesn't. Jim Gates doesn't. Okay. And maybe even most working string theorists do. I don't know. I've been told different things by different people. So this is by no means, I'm not saying that the string community believes that the definition of science should be changed, but some prominent people have been arguing that very prominently. Okay. So that's, and there's no place to go with that. That's the present situation, except 5 minutes, if I can have them, about the other two roads, which will be very quick. Because the history of science teaches us, I think, that it's never really true that theories just survive on their own up or down. They survive by competition with other theories. And there's a, as I said, a very old and deep-seated competition. Okay. Now, I have a lot more transparencies, but I'll try to make the core of the argument is that there are two other roads, and some of the directions in those other roads make predictions which are testable. Okay. The basic problem when you start from a background independent point of view, you don't have things in space, you have some quantum dynamical system which doesn't look like space or geometry at all, and you have to get space back as some low energy approximate description of it. And that's the basic hard problem. Recently, there's been a lot of progress in that from several directions. One is a model called causal dynamical triangulations, which is a kind of Ising model of quantum gravity. It's the simplest possible background independent description of geometry you could do. You just stick triangles or higher dimensional versions of triangles together in all possible ways to make all possible geometries with some Hamiltonian or action and study the dynamics. And Renata Lowell and collaborators have shown that when causality is incorporated in causal structure in the right way, microscopically, you get out generically in a large class of models 3+1 dimensions at large distances. And this is a triumph, and it also means that all the time that we thought that we could make a Euclidean continuation and work without causal structure and then continue back at the end, where we were wrong. So, I mean, this is a disproof of a basic methodology in the field, and therefore I mention it. Now, let me come back to observation. Okay. As I said, one of the three ways to get at quantum gravity observationally is to ask, what's the symmetry of the ground state? Okay. Now, in particle physics, we know what the symmetry of the ground state is. It's Poincaré invariants, Lorentz transformations and translations in space and time. But in general relativity, these are not symmetries of general relativity. They're symmetries of a solution which happens to be the lowest energy or the zero energy solution of general relativity. So they're symmetries of a solution, not symmetries of the theory. Therefore, in classical general relativity, it's a dynamical question whether this symmetry is realized or not. And therefore, any quantum theory of gravity, which is not dependent on, if there's a fixed background, then the symmetries of the ground state are the symmetries of the background. If there's no fixed background, then the symmetry of the ground state is a dynamical question. Okay? There turn out to be three possibilities which experiment can distinguish and which theories can distinguish. Okay. One, Poincaré invariance, just like classical, just like ordinary quantum field theory. Two, Lorentz invariance is broken, i.e. there's a preferred frame that appears when you do experiments at order L Planck or L Planck squared. Okay. And three, something new called deformed Poincaré invariance. This is a consistent modification of special relativity, both kinematically and dynamically, which captures effects of quantum gravity. So it's a kind of phenomenological model of how quantum gravity could manifest itself in the low energy limit. And it has implications for real experiments. And these are some of the inventors, Giovanni Emiliano Camelia, Jean Maguejo, Sabina Hossenfelder. For those people who believe that the Planck scale is a TeV and extra dimensions are large, she has worked out what the LHC will see as a consequence of doubly special relativity if the Planck scale is a TeV. Okay. Although the idea actually goes back to Snyder in 1947. It's one of these ideas that was published several times and ignored. Okay. So I'll just tell you its principles. I'll tell you the experimental implications. And then I think I'll stop there. There's much more to say about these directions, but I'll stop. Because this will make my case that that quantum gravity is still an experimental area. Okay. So you know the principles of relativity. Okay. There's the relativity of inertial frames, and there's a constancy of C of velocity, which all observers agree on. Okay. Doubly special relativity adds the constancy of an energy, which we assume to be the Planck energy, or of order the Planck energy, an energy that, unlike energies in special relativity, all observers agree on. And the speed of light becomes now only the universal speed of photons in most realizations of this, for energies much less than this invariant energy. So it's modifications of the principles of special relativity. This has consequences, since this has been really intensively studied since about 2000. The energy-momentum relations are modified, which implies an energy-dependent speed of light. Okay. Although there are some people think there are ways to get around that, so there's a little controversy in the field, but I'm not convinced. Momentum space has constant curvature. The space-time geometry is non-commutative. These turn out to be equivalent statements. The metric becomes energy-dependent. Okay. So if you like, there's a fifth dimension, which is the energy scale of the geometry, that you're probing the geometry. Probably this is equivalent to the first two that's still being worked on. The usual energy-momentum conservation relations become nonlinear. That's related to momentum space having constant curvature. And there's a new conservation law. Okay. Now we know, due to recent work, actually we had evidence when this refers to a 2003 paper, now we know from a complete solution by Levine and Friedel, that quantum gravity, background-independent approaches to quantum gravity, in particular spin-foam models, which are a path integral version of background-independent approaches to quantum gravity, with matter in 2 plus 1 dimensions predict this. So that if the world had one dimension less of space, we would have predictions. Okay? And as you're right to laugh, okay. The situation is that we have reason, there's some evidence, but far from proof that this is true in 3 plus 1 in the real world, but it's true in 2 plus 1. Okay, now, a little bit for the experimentalists, if that's okay. Can I go 3 more minutes? Yeah, okay. And then I can end. Okay, so how are we going to detect? So now you knew about the other two. The other two possibilities. So here we have 3 possibilities. Okay. One, that Poincaré invariance is just true as given, which, by the way, is what the versions of string theory that we understand predict, because the versions of string theory, one of the consistency conditions that's applied to string theory is that it agree with Poincaré invariance. Okay. Two, that there's a preferred frame at the Planck scale, and special relativity is just wrong, and Newton was wrong, and Galileo was wrong, and so forth. There's an ether. And there's a surprising number of good scientists who believe that that's probably the way things work out, like Ted Jacobson, other people whose names are escaping me. Okay. Or this modification of energy of special relativity. There are 2 basic low-energy effects. Energy-momentum relations become corrected, so E squared is P squared plus M squared plus higher order terms. Velocities become corrected, so the speed of light increases with energy, and conservation laws become modified. There are basic consequences, like energy dependence of the speed of photons, neutrinos, and modifications of thresholds for collision processes which depend on conservation laws plus special relativity. Okay. And these turn out to be experiments that probe those that are sufficient or will be sufficient in a few years' time to distinguish them. So the GZK threshold is a famous example. An experiment that nature has been doing for us
for billions of years and just waiting for us to pick up the answer is colliding very high energy cosmic rays with cosmic microwave background photons.
There's a threshold to produce pions or electron-positron pairs, and at those thresholds, okay, the cosmic ray protons lose energy. And hence, it was predicted, this blue curve was predicted in the 60s. This is the cosmic ray spectrum. This is the cosmic ray spectrum multiplied by the energy cubed, rather, because the spectrum is falling like 1 over energy cubed. This is the energy. This is 10 to the 19 electron volts. This is 10 to the 20 electron volts. And it was predicted, this blue curve, that because of that, of hitting that threshold where you produce pions particularly, the cosmic ray spectrum would cut off. This is some data from a Japanese experiment called AGASA that saw a significant number of events over the threshold. Okay? There is the energy-dependent speed of light issue accumulates for long distances so that even if the effect is tiny, okay, between the highest and lowest gamma rays seen from gamma ray bursts, traveling for 10 billion light years, the difference in arrival time is on the order of a hundredth or a thousandth of a second on Earth, which is well within what modern electronics can see. And the claim, I'm told, is that the present limits for this correction are sort of less than a thousand. And the GLASS satellite to launch in about a year will be able, after taking data for a few years, I'm told, and there's a paper out about this, I think, yesterday from NASA Goddard, will be able to put good limits on order one on this. Now, the energy dependence of the speed of light could be even or could be odd. That is, it could be that left-handed photons go faster and right-handed ones go slower, or they both go faster with increasing energy. If it's odd, that turns out to reflect breaking of Lorentz symmetry. That reflects the existence of a preferred frame. That causes bifringence, that is the rotation of planes of polarization, and that is already ruled out to order L. Planck by many orders of magnitude by observations of distant polarized radio galaxies. So astrophysicists are already doing some experiments at not just at the scale L. Planck times the energy, but at the scale 4 or 5 orders of magnitude times L. Planck times the energy. Okay. The parity even case, which is deformation and not breaking of Lorentz invariance, is not yet ruled out by order L. Planck, but it might be ruled out by future experiments. Okay, let me wind up. Okay. So, of the three possibilities, there are two experiments. Okay. If AGASA, I didn't say the key thing. The AGASA experiment is being redone by Auger, which will shortly, within a year or two, have enough data to confirm or reject the conclusion that there is or is not a threshold where special relativity says it should be in the scattering of protons, cosmic ray protons, in the cosmic microwave background. Okay. If there is, then it turns out Lorentz invariance is broken, period. Although then there's a conflict with the astrophysical experiment I just told you about. If there isn't, then there remains the possibility of Poincaré invariance is right, as string theory, the string theories which have been written down predict, or that Poincaré invariance is deformed, as is suggested by calculations in background-independent forms of quantum gravity, and that could be decided by GLAST. So the point is that different approaches to quantum gravity do make different predictions for experiments that are underway, okay? And therefore quantum gravity is an experimental subject, and therefore there is no reason to respond positively to those people who seek to have the methodology of science modified in order to say that theory should be considered possibly true even if they don't make any predictions for experiment. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Questions? Yeah. So I think I missed something here. If background dependent and background independent approaches are two of the roads, what's the third?
I didn't have time for the third road. The third road are people like Roger Penrose and Gerard de Tooft and Steve Adler, who say that quantum mechanics is just wrong and there needs to be a new formulation of quantum theory that goes beyond quantum mechanics, and the problem of unification with gravity is to be solved there. Okay, and those, I'm sorry, I didn't have time to get to everything I was going to say, and though some of those proposals, particularly Roger Penrose's, also have experimental implications because they have collapse of the wave function happening as a spontaneous process due to mediated by the geometry of space-time. And so there are predictions which may be within realm of a delicate satellite experiment for basically decoherence caused by nonlinear effects in quantum mechanics coming from something else. Okay. Yeah?
How many background independent
approaches? Yes, very good. So the claim is so first of all, in having have been studied so far or not. So let me make it very clear. I am not making the claim, okay, that background independent approaches are able to solve either the issue of unification cleanly or the issue of the landscape. Okay, so that claim is not being made. Okay. And I'll answer your question in a minute, but I want to make it very clear that claim is not being made. Let me answer the question in the context of a particular well-developed theory, which is spin foam models, which are path integral approaches to loop quantum gravity, which I didn't get to mention loop quantum gravity, but I talked about it here a few years ago, and I will talk about it again in January here. Okay. And it's a approach that many people work on that comes from combining general relativity in the Ashtekar formulation with quantum field theory. And there is a path integral formulation, and how many of there are of those are there, and what does it say about coupling to matter, and so forth. Okay. So first, without any coupling to matter, the answer is that we don't know, but there certainly are a variety of approaches. And we don't know how many distinct ones there are that have good properties that the ones which have been studied have. So the ones which have been studied, the Barrett-Crane model and alternatives to the Barrett-Crane model, have good properties, for example, ultraviolet finiteness. And there's several other good properties. How large is the space of parameters of the theories that can be formulated like spin foam models that have those properties? We don't know. Okay. Can these theories incorporate coupling to matter? And by matter, I mean the matter of the standard model, fermions, gauge fields, etc. And are there parameters that describe those possible couplings? The answer to both of those appears to be yes. Okay. That is, you give a version of a gauge theory coupled to fermions and you can code it into a spin foam model. Okay. So it appears to be possible to represent any version of particle physics that you'd like. Okay. And therefore, the question of unification is not really addressed, and the question of where the parameters of the standard model come from is not really addressed. Okay. Now, there is a new development, which I don't want to do more than just note, because that's what I'll be talking about when I'm talking about here. It's due primarily to Fotini-Markopoulou. Well, it's actually two developments. One due to her and David Krebs at Guelph, who use methods from quantum information theory to show that many of these quantum gravity models, and we always use the word models, many of these models have excitations in them which have protected degrees of freedom in the sense of quantum information theory, that is noiseless subsystems, that people know that language, that have independently conserved conservation laws, i.e. there are excitations in language, there are excitations of quantum geometry that propagate as if they were elementary particles carrying their own conservation laws. And this opens up a possibility for starting with a model with no matter in it and getting matter out as excitations necessarily. But this has been under development for less than a year. I'll give a seminar about it, and a number of other people are working on it. So there's certainly no claims to be made. Okay. Let me address more generally. To me, okay, the issue of whether a quantum theory of gravity should be made background independent, okay, is the crucial issue. Okay, whether string theory can be made background independent, we simply don't know. There's been a little bit of work on it. I've spent a little bit of time. Other people have spent some time. Okay, not enough work has been done to decide that question. Okay. If there is a background independent form of string theory, then there is probably a landscape issue, and let me put a positive spin on the landscape issue. Because after all, I wrote about the landscape issue before it was an issue, and I put a positive spin on it, and let me put the positive spin on it. Okay. In the history of science, there are properties of nature that we believe are necessary and properties that we believe are contingent. Properties which are necessary, okay, in Newtonian mechanics, for example, is the geometry of space. In special relativity is the geometry of space-time. Okay. In the standard model of particle physics are the gauge couplings, the structure of the gauge couplings, and so forth. Properties that are contingent are properties that differ in different solutions of a theory. Okay. Now, in the history of physics, okay, properties have a habit of migrating from the necessary list to the contingent list. For example, the geometry of space was thought to be three-dimensional Euclidean. Kant had arguments why it had to be that. And in general relativity, the geometry of space migrated to the contingent column. It depends on the solution to Einstein's equations that you choose and where you are in the solution of Einstein's equations. Okay. In the standard model of particle physics, an aspect of a property that was usually thought to be in the necessary column, that is the masses of the fermions, migrates to the contingent column because the masses of the fermions turn out to depend on the expectation value of the Higgs field, and that turns out to depend on the physical phase of the universe. The universe can be, in most Higgs theories, in different dynamical phases in some phases of which the fermions are massless, in other phases of which they have different masses. So the masses, we're already familiar with the idea that the masses of particles may migrate to the contingent column. Okay. There is an argument to be made, I'm not going to make it here, but I made it in that book, that making theories background independent, i.e. making them more relational, does two things. It migrates properties from the necessary column to the contingent column. Okay. And, however, it does so in a way which makes them testable. Okay. Because the issue is not whether we have a landscape of string theories. The issue is, do we live in a cosmology, and can we study a cosmological scenario such that there are a lot of falsifiable predictions as a consequence of the properties of elementary particles being in the contingent column? Okay. And the issue that I raise, and the issue that I raise in the book and that I raised actually in my first book, is there a landscape of string theories? That's a technical issue, and there either is. I mean, there's pretty good evidence for it. It could be that in the end, all those theories that we think exist and have stable moduli don't really exist to higher order and perturbation theory, but that's a technical issue. Okay. The issue that I wanted to raise is that if we do have a candidate for a fundamental theory in which the properties of the elementary particles are in the contingent column, okay, then we are still required to make experimental predictions by doable experiments. Okay. And the thing that worried me in the literature was the prominence of claims by prominent people that we didn't have to do this. Okay. That by use of already understood to be failed ideas based on the anthropic principle, somehow we could live with the landscape of string theories even if we didn't have a methodology or a cosmological scenario which let us make a large number of predictions. Okay. So that, for me, is the issue and always was the issue. Okay. And I hope that as time goes on, that issue is discussed and debated, because I think one way or the other, it has to be resolved. I don't want to talk. This is the question period, not the answer period. Yeah. Well, there's somebody up here, then I'll come to you. Yeah. Yes. Very good question. Okay. If space-time geometry is emergent, why shouldn't space-time dimension be emergent? Indeed, why not space-time topology, dimension, etc.? Okay. And from a philosophical point of view, I agree with you, it should be. Okay. The state of the art is the following. Okay. Let me back up. General relativity is a theory where the metric is dynamical and there is no fixed background for the metric, but the dimension of space and the topology of space are fixed. That is, there are no... you can study general relativity for different dimensions and different topologies, okay, but the set of solutions for those different choices live in disjoint configuration spaces or phase spaces, and there's no processes that can dynamically evolve to change the geometry, to change the topology or change the dimension. Okay. When general relativity is quantized, as in loop quantum gravity or spin foam models, okay, that remains the case because we took a classical theory which had a certain phase space and represented its algebra quantum mechanically in an operator algebra in a Hilbert space. Okay. Now, could that theory be modified so as to give up the choice of dimension and topology? And the answer is yes, and many people advocated that about 10 years ago because the classification of the states and the histories which are involve combinatorial structures like graphs embedded in 3 and 4 dimensions, the classification of the states and the histories would be much simpler if we didn't have to embed them in a fixed topology. And for example, my colleagues, I mean, for different reasons, Laurent Friedel and Fotini Marcopulo advocated giving up further structure in the background. Okay. And it's been studied. It turns out that it's much harder because what you give up, you have to get back. And you can find both things now studied in the literature, and we're clear which one we're studying in a particular paper or a particular calculation. Most of the strong results, that is the ultraviolet finiteness works for either. The studies of the graviton propagator work only for the embedded one. The emergence of excitations, which are particles, works only for the embedded one. So the question is under study. So that's not as... I can interpret your question in a way in which I think it's very relevant. Okay, I may not answer the question you're asking, but I'll answer... I'll answer a question that I think is very pertinent. Okay, supposing it's true that that there is a landscape of fundamental theories, okay, whether it's string theory or anything else. Okay. Therefore, the properties that any individual solution could have, which is a universe with some version of particle physics in it, are completely contingent. Okay. Can we do science? Can we make falsifiable predictions? My belief, okay, is that we can, if we study how the biologists succeeded to do science in the same situation. That is, here's the analogy. There's a big space of genotypes, a vast space of genotypes. It maps on, in a complicated way, as you know, to a vast space of phenotypes. And it's possible to imagine all kinds of creatures. Okay? And consequently, one might believe that it was impossible to do biology scientifically because any creature might exist somewhere and might have some properties. Okay? But it turns out that that's not true. And the reason it's not true is that the ensemble of individual organisms that exist at any one time in the biosphere were created by a process, a statistical process, natural selection, okay, which puts the probability measure on a very narrow, still large, but very narrow set of possible genotypes or phenotypes. Okay. And all those that have sufficient probability measure share certain properties. Like almost, and I was just reading Richard Dawkins' recent book about this, okay, almost every existing organism, okay, is pretty optimized. You can always find ways to optimize a little bit, but there are many ways. Of course, most mutations are neutral drift, but there are many more ways to decrease fitness by a small change than increase fitness. Many, many more ways to, okay, for, okay, and that's a prediction. And there are many, many other predictions which follow from the fact that the ensemble was created by a certain statistical process. Okay. So my advice from biologists to physicists is that if we physicists are faced with a similar problem, okay, we should employ or search to employ or hope to employ a similar strategy because it's the only strategy. There might be some other strategy out there that works, okay, but it's the only one that's actually ever been found to work. And roughly speaking, if there's a mapping of properties from necessity to contingency, and you know, sort of to quote Minow, natural selection is something that takes you from contingency and drives you back towards necessity. Okay? And if that worked for biology, for reasons that can be well understood mathematically just from applications of statistics, it should work for physics too.
Okay, I think the rest of the questions should be left for private asking. Let's thank the speaker again.